Mojave Beach Productions.
Mojave Beach Productions and the Voice of Haulana bring you stories of faith and inspiration, made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International.
Mojave Beach Productions and the Voice of Haulana present Dear Dean, Love, Mom, made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International and narrated by Esther Luttrell.
Episode 3.
Sometime before the Austin workshop, I was at home working on a screenplay when I received a phone call from a lady in Florida who said she'd seen my name and had written down my phone number, though she wasn't sure why. Recently, I gave a talk about the writing of this book. The morning of the day I was to speak, I was plotting out what I would be discussing, and I came to this section of my story. That's when I realized I didn't know the name of the woman I'd be talking about. I did remember, however, that she'd written a play. I even recalled the title. So I Googled it. When I saw her name as the author, I recognized it immediately. I tried then to make contact, but without success. If I'd had any idea all those years ago that I would someday write a book about the telephone experience between that woman and myself, I would have asked permission to quote her, but it never dawned on me. I promise you, though, that the incident happened the way I'm about to tell you. Nothing has been changed except the names. Mrs. Luttrell, the caller began uncertainly. Yes? My name is Laura Mahin. I'm calling from, and she named the city. I'm not a frivolous person. I'm president of the Women's League and director of the local community theater, but I read something about you and managed to get your phone number because... And she stopped. For a moment, I wondered if we'd been disconnected. Then she said, I've never called anyone like this before. She hesitated again. Well, she was right in saying that she wasn't frivolous. At least she certainly didn't sound frivolous. She sounded like a woman who might be calling to ask if I'd be attending the symphony with her club. Very cultured, very well modulated, very confused. I don't know why I'm telling you this, she said at last, but my son Andy killed himself recently. She went on to tell me the circumstances of his suicide, which I won't bother repeating here. But I gathered from what she said that Andy was a sweet young man. I believe she said he was 19. I gathered, too, that he was a slow learner with the heart of a child. His dearest wish, she said, was to please. It was because he felt mistakenly that he had let her down, he took his own life. Although it was evident that Laura Mahin was distraught, she was holding up very well, considering. What I didn't know was what I could do for her. I told her that I, too, had just lost my son, so I understood her grief. As to why she felt impressed to call me, a total stranger, all the way in California when she was on the other side of the country, neither of us could imagine. I was at my desk, sitting in front of a picture window overlooking my driveway. The day was bright and clear. Totally absorbed in what Laura Mahin was struggling to say, I happened to glance out the window. And I saw Dean. He was no more than 6 feet on the other side of the window, in the middle of the driveway, and he was grinning at me. Beside him stood a kid about his height, 5'9", and around his same weight, 130 pounds or so. The lad's left elbow rested on Dean's right shoulder. The fingers of both hands were laced together in front of him. His left leg was crossed over his right one. And he, too, was grinning. Two buddies in my driveway grinning at me, solid as wood. Oh, my heaven, I interrupted my caller. My son's in my driveway. What'd you say? He's standing there grinning at me, and there's somebody with him, a young man. Your son is in your driveway? Wait a minute, let me describe the fellow with him. As impossible as it seemed, I knew the kid with Dean had to be Andy, just had to be. I told her that he had collar length, light brown hair, which appeared to be natural curly. She said nothing. I went on to describe his height and his weight. He's slender, like Dean, but he looks like he might play a sport, maybe basketball. He's more toned than Dean. I remember I said, his eyes are very big, very round. From here, they appear to be hazel, and he has deep dimples. Her voice was unsteady, but she was still with me. What's he wearing? Both of the boys had on jeans and tennis shoes. The fellow beside Dean had on a short-sleeved, striped t-shirt. Aqua stripes, I told her. Horizontal, not vertical. It has a white collar, and there's something on the pocket, an emblem of some kind, though it doesn't look like an alligator. That's what he was wearing when he died, she whispered. Dean and Andy stood there in front of me, as alive as they had been on Earth, eyes dancing with good humor, for at least a full 3 minutes before they vanished. Well, I wish I could remember the rest of my conversation with Mrs. Mahin, but I can't. She said she'd written a play about Andy's life and death and that it was being produced locally. I know that. Much, much later, someone told me it got as far as Off-Broadway, but I have no proof of that, and I took no notes that day. As I said earlier, it showed up when I Googled it recently, so she's still producing it after all these years. Well, when we finally hung up, I was pretty shaken. I mean, what do you do when you've witnessed a miracle? Do you just get up and fix a cup of coffee? File your nails? Take a little nap? Call the local news station and give them a bulletin? Oh, not hardly. How do you get on with whatever it was you were doing before seeing your kid and his friend who are no longer on the planet? I had to tell somebody. So I called Brooke. I told her the whole thing just as it happened, starting with a call from Andy's mother. When I'd finished, Brooke said, Mom, of course you saw Dean and Andy. I did too, though I didn't know who it was with him. Remember the day I called you and said I was outside going into the backyard to tend flowers when I felt like somebody was watching me? I turned and saw Dean at the far corner of the house by the driveway. He was just standing there smiling at me. Remember I told you there was a fellow about Dean's age back by the road? And he was standing there, you know, like a friend does when they're waiting. I even told you what Dean's friend had on, a striped t-shirt and jeans. Don't you remember? Huh, how to confess that I had forgotten. I forgot because, well, to be honest, I didn't believe she really saw Dean. I think she wanted to see him. I think she thought or imagined she saw him. But I didn't believe she actually saw him. I had listened to her tell me about it, and I had dismissed it as a grieving sister's longing. I sat in my chair for a long time after Brooke and I hung up, and I thought the whole thing through again, and again, and again. It really was Dean outside my window, in good health and good humor. And the kid beside him was Andy. I mean, it had to be Andy. But what was the purpose? What was I supposed to know or do about it? There was no one I could repeat it to outside my daughter who'd believe me. There was nothing I could do but cherish the moment and question it. If there was a purpose, God would have to burn that bush I keep talking about, because I sure as the world wasn't getting it. The Austin workshop was set for a few months in the future. I was eager to fill the gap between then and now. For no good reason that I can recall, I settled on going to Charlotte, North Carolina first. I didn't know anyone in Charlotte or any place else in North Carolina. I'd been there when I was a child. Where hadn't I been when I was a child? And I had pleasant memories of a log cabin somewhere in the mountains when I was about 11. I remember that it was autumn. The leaves made a thick, crunchy carpet on the pine needle-covered ground. With other children, I'd catch fireflies at night to put in glass jars. Maybe it was because of that wonderful association of fireflies and autumn leaves that I decided Charlotte was to be next on our agenda. I contacted the city's Mint Museum of Art to arrange for a room in which to hold our weekend class. Then I set about finding a caterer who would understand my concept of picnic basket lunches for the students. They not only understood, they topped each basket with a big fluffy quilt. The weather that Saturday and Sunday was exceptional. Everyone spread their quilt on the museum lawn and we ate there. The workshop went very well. Attendance was several times over what we'd had in Kansas City. Frank Dooley and Philip Horn, President and Vice President of the North Carolina Film Foundation, and the wonderful North Carolina Film Commissioner Bill Arnold, now retired, were our guest speakers. I had placed a tiny ad in a film industry magazine called Reel, R-E-E-L, Carolina, published in Wilmington, where Dino DeLaurentiis owned Caracol Studios. It later became Screen Gems, though it was still run by the same person who had run Caracol, Frank Capra Jr. Wilmington had, and still has, quite a movie-making community going for itself. I became friends with one of the reporters on the magazine when she called me in Seal Beach for an interview. In response to her question about why I was producing workshops around the country, I told her about Dean. She ended up writing a story about how he inspired me. In the article, she referred to Dean as an angel on her shoulder. A couple of weeks before we were scheduled to leave for North Carolina, I received a phone call from a woman in Charlotte whom I'll call Tina Watson, asking if I would edit her screenplay. I'd really love to use her real name, but again, I didn't anticipate that a book would come of these experiences, and I've since lost contact with her. Without permission to use her name, I'll use a fictitious one to protect her privacy. When I got Tina's script, I was delighted to see that it was a well-written comedy. Over the next couple of weeks, we became telephone friends, though she really knew nothing about Dean, except that he was my son and that he had died. I shared no details about him with her. Tina worked out religiously every day in the swimming pool at the country club where she was a member. When she related the following story to me, she said that on this particular day, a storm was threatening. She was alone in the outdoor pool. In fact, there didn't appear to be anyone else on the premises. On her second or third lap, she heard a young male voice call out, "Thank you for being my mother's friend." Tina stopped in tread water, looking around. Gray clouds tumbled overhead. Lightning was visible in the distance. The grounds were empty and the clubhouse dark. She lifted one side of her swim cap to hear better. Deciding that it must have been her imagination, she fastened the cap back in place, preparing to resume her swim, when she heard the voice again. "Thank you for being my mother's friend." She said it frightened her enough that she got out of the pool and went to the locker room to dress. Driving home, she had the distinct impression she should call me, which she did. "Did Dean have a rather deep voice?" she asked. I told her that he did. "I think he spoke to me today," she said. After she described what happened, she added, "I don't know anyone else whose son is deceased, or who would have a reason to give me that kind of message." She had always been convinced it was Dean. And I confess, it makes sense, in a way. I'm not sure why he would have said something like that to Tina when she and I had never met. We were really no more than writer-editor acquaintances. But even though I don't know why, I am certain I know who. The following Sunday, I hadn't yet gotten up when the phone rang in my bedroom. Larry was downstairs, so I was alone when I picked up the receiver. "Hello? Is this Esther Luttrell?" a man's voice asked. I said that it was. "I know you're going to think I'm nuts," he began, "but I had to call you. My name is Jimmy Kane." Sorry, folks, not his real name, but the words in the story are real. "I don't know how to say what I want to say." His conversation so far certainly had a familiar ring. "Are you a writer?" I asked. "No, I was a ski instructor in Colorado. That's why I'm calling. I don't know how else to begin except to jump in and tell it." A pause, and then, "I was living it up pretty good. I mean, I had a snazzy car, great bachelor pad, and pretty girls were all over me. I'm a tall guy and not too bad looking if you aren't real particular. He chuckled self-consciously. My mom works in a statewide prison program she created. She goes in and counsels inmates, inspiring them, encouraging, trying to get them to see the better part of themselves. Everybody loves her, even the toughest old birds. He went on, she always hoped I'd settle down and come back home. She lives in a little town in North Carolina. That's where I come from, but I was having too much fun in Colorado's high life, if you know what I mean. One day, and this is why I'm calling you, I got a phone call from my grandma. That's my mother's mama. She's a spitfire, got more energy than me any day. She and my mom are just real close, like girlfriends. She came by the house every morning of the world, even 7 days a week, if Mom was in town, so they could gossip and have coffee together. This one day she came by and found Mom on the kitchen floor. Later we found out Mom had gotten up in the middle of the night for a glass of water. She tripped on a chair in the dark and cracked her head pretty bad in a fall. There was lots of blood. She was still unconscious when Grammy got there. Was this going to be about the death of his mother? Was Dean connected to his story in some way? When I got a call that Mom was in the hospital, I drove straight back to North Carolina. And she was in critical condition. The doctor wasn't sure she was going to make it. He paused. When he spoke again, I could hear the emotion rising in his voice. I went out in the waiting room and I had a talk with God. I said, God, if you make her well, I'll move back home and get a decent job. I'll stop the wildlife. I promise I'll stop the wildlife. I'll take care of Mom, and I'll live a clean life from this minute on. I swear to you. Well, God must have heard Jimmy's plea. His mother made a full recovery, and good for his word, Jimmy packed his things and moved back to his hometown in North Carolina. I had to go back to Colorado to clear up some things, he said, so Grammy drove me to the airport. She was real glad I was coming home to settle down. When we got where we were going and I started to get out of the car, she said, Jimmy, there's a story in here I want you to read. And she handed me a magazine I'd never heard of before, Real Carolina. Now he really had my attention. But where in the world was this tale headed, I wondered. I thought maybe she'd have the page marked that she wanted me to read, but when I got settled on board and thumbed through the magazine, I didn't see anything she thought I thought she might have been talking about. Pretty soon, I put the magazine in the seat beside me, and I went to sleep. I remember the plane was really nearly empty. I think there were only four or five people on it besides me, and none of them anywhere near me. I dozed for a bit, and when I woke up, the first thing I noticed was that the magazine was open. It was still lying in the seat next to me where I'd put it, but it was open. I know when I tossed it over there, it was closed. I wondered if somebody came and sat next to me while I was asleep, and that was a weird feeling. Who'd come and sit down by me to read my magazine while I slept. Then I wondered if the attendant maybe picked it up and glanced at it and tossed it down again. Anyway, it was lying there open, and the first thing I saw was a line that said, "He is an angel on her shoulder." I felt the goosebumps begin to rise. I thought, now that's something Grandma would have read, and maybe wanted me to read too. So I picked it up and I read it, and I don't know. It touched me. I wasn't sure what to say to him. I just wanted to tell you that I'm awfully sorry about your boy, he said. I hope you don't think I'm a nutcase. No, not at all, I assured him. I asked about his mother, and he said she was doing well, and she was back at work in the prison system. But we never did figure during the course of that conversation exactly why he felt so compelled to call. But I was fine with it. Jimmy called me again on Monday just to say hello, and then he called on Tuesday as well. I didn't mind that at all. In fact, I liked him. When he called on the fourth day, though, his voice was racked with sobs. After a moment, he caught his breath, and he was able to speak again. He said, I'm sorry to bother you with this, but I felt like I had to tell you. Grammy lives with her son, my uncle. Yesterday morning, when she didn't come down for breakfast, he went up to her room to see what was keeping her. She was sitting in the rocking chair, dressed in her white nightgown, just peaceful as could be, and she was gone. His voice broke. I made sympathetic sounds, but I'm not sure he heard me. Finally, he managed to say, when I got back from closing out my things in Colorado, I'd asked Grandma if that story about you and your son was the one she wanted me to read. She said it was. Why, do you think? Well, I never thought much about life after we die until I read that story in the magazine. After that, Grammy and I talked about it a little, not much, but some. Enough so I know she wasn't afraid to die. And now I can have some peace with it, too. I marveled at what Dean was able to do, for surely he had orchestrated the whole thing. Where did it begin, though? Did he arrange for the Wilmington reporter to call me about the article? For her to be inspired to write it? For Jimmy's grandmother to find it? For Jimmy to read it? All of this prior to his grandmother's crossing so that Jimmy would be able to bear the pain and know the comforting truth that his grandparent hadn't stopped living, but had only shed her earthly form. Of course, to be honest, what I thought mostly was how in heaven's name could I write a screenplay about Jimmy's experience? After all, that was certainly to be my part in this whole thing. That's why Dean was sending all of these people to me, wasn't it? To help them write a screenplay about their experiences. With all of the reassurances Dean had given me, with all of the reassurance I'd been giving others, you'd think I'd have found some joy in my life again, but that wasn't the case. I was still having trouble sleeping, still feeling the physical pang of grief. I'd go long stretches during the day when I'd think I was all right, then, for no apparent reason, the fist of my solar plexus would double me over and I'd be kneeling on the floor, tears streaming. I have no recollection of anything in particular happening prior to what I'm about to tell you. I don't know if it had been one of my worst or my best days. I just know that it was nighttime and I had finally fallen asleep. I don't know how long I slept when I had a dream. You know the kind, where it's so real you're sure you're there, the way Dean described his March 17th dream. When I visited the place where Dean goes when he needs to think, it was not a dream. I was fully awake. But this was different. This time, I was sound asleep. I found myself in my dream, sitting on a long wooden bench that ran the length of a narrow corridor. The wall across from me was made of stained glass, floor to ceiling. Sunlight spilled onto the beige gold carpeting. The corridor was quite long. I kept looking toward an open door at its far end, as if I was expecting someone. To my right, slightly behind me, was an opening of, perhaps 8 feet. Four wide carpeted steps went down to another room that I couldn't see from where I was seated. Pretty soon Dean came bounding up those steps. I looked around at him and I got to my feet. He grinned and grabbed my hands, pulling me along with him as we turned to go down those same steps together. There was a ledge built into the wall to my right. Fern grew out of a recess. Sitting on the ledge were two casually dressed girls who looked to me like college students. They each wore white shorts and white shirts that looked something like a man's short-sleeved dress shirt. The young women were each reading a book. One girl's legs dangled down over the side of the ledge. The other, seated beside her, had one leg tucked up under her. She was toying with a strand of her light brown, shoulder-length hair as she read. The first girl glanced at Dean as we hurried past. She smiled, gave him a little wave. He waved back. And we were at the far end of a very long expanse of what appeared to be the lobby of an exclusive club of some sort. You know, it's the kind of place I associate with, old money. The beams in the high ceiling and on the walls were made of dark wood, polished to a high sheen. Beige gold carpeting stretched all the way to revolving doors. And closer to those doors, along the left wall, I could see what looked like a check-in counter, you know, the kind found in any upscale hotel or resort. As Dean guided me into the lobby, a young man about Dean's age, wearing long white trousers and a white shirt open at the neck, came jogging toward us. As he trotted past, he said, "Need anything from the pharmacy, Dean?" Dean replied, "No, thanks." The fellow sprinted up those four steps that we had just come down. "There's a pharmacy in heaven?" I asked, puzzled. Dean tilted his head back and chuckled. Then he stopped, turned me to face him, and put both arms around my waist. Looking down at me with a twinkle in his eyes, he said, "No, Mom, this isn't heaven." I lay my head against his chest. Now, this is real important, so pay attention. I had my arms around his waist, and I remember being aware of how his shirt felt. It was made of soft white cotton, a dress shirt, like the young man who passed us a moment ago had been wearing. And I was aware of the fabric. I could feel Dean inside the fabric. As my cheek pressed against him, I felt the hair on his chest tickle my nose. His collar was open, a small wedge of curls poked up through the V, and I could smell the scent of him. I remember thinking, "Oh my goodness, not heaven. Then where?" That's when I looked up at him again. Our arms were still around each other, and I was embarrassed to say it, so I wrinkled my nose playfully, and I ventured, well, it's not hell. I made it a question. That really made him chuckle. "No, Mom, it isn't hell." We turned back to the lobby, our arms still around each other's waist, and started across the carpet, walking slowly in step. "Then where is it?" I asked. "It's a place where I can study and work on my spirituality," he replied, matter of fact. And the dream ended. I sat up in bed. Had I actually been with him in that lovely building? I'd never heard of any place like that described by those who've had contact with the other side until I read Bill and Judy Guggenheim's book, Hello from Heaven, 6 years later. In an accounting of a woman's experience with a departed loved one, she described exactly that setting. Well, make of it what you will. I believe I was there. I think Dean was, once again, letting me know that he was alive and well. He was working on his spiritual development. I have no idea what was at the pharmacy, but that was only the beginning of a lot of things I wouldn't understand for a very long time. Just before our trip to Austin, I had a call from yet another woman I'd never met. Like the others, she started the conversation hesitantly. I was looking at the paper today," she said after my hello, "and I saw your ad about a workshop you're going to be giving. My name's Diane Hooper. I own a talent agency here in Austin, and believe me, I've seen every kind of glitzy ad and promotional brochure that's ever been printed. And that's why I was so surprised at my reaction to your little notice in the paper." I really hadn't wanted to spend much on newspaper promotion. I'm not convinced it's cost-effective. My 2-inch ad said simply, "Screenwriting workshop left by Hollywood pros." Under that was the date we would be in town and my telephone number. Diane Hooper was gaining confidence and still talking. I know this sounds crazy, but when I saw that ad, I felt, I don't know how to put it, I felt like I had to speak to you. I mean, had to speak to you. "Well," I said cautiously, "to be honest, I got a call very much like this from a woman I've never met not too long ago." Thinking about Andy's mother, I had to be careful how I asked the question that was on my mind. "Have you by any chance lost a loved one recently? Maybe a son?" I heard her voice catch. It was a full second or so before she said, "Two sons." I remember that I'd been standing beside my desk when I took the call. Now I sunk into a chair. Good Lord, what was happening? I glanced in the driveway to see if Dean was there. He wasn't. "I'm so sorry," I said to her. "But it wasn't recently, it was a while back. PBS did a documentary on it. In fact, it'll be showing again this Sunday. It's called Sharks. Have you seen it?" No, I don't think so. "Well, my husband and I, we just bought a yacht. We kept it in a Florida harbor, but we wanted to take it to another port further up the coast. Well, we set out on a bright, clear afternoon, and water was perfectly calm. My sons, Billy, Gerald, Edward, and Tex, they were pretty excited. Billy was 10. Gerald was about 12 years old. Diana Jo was a teen, so she was much cooler about it. Melissa was just 4, a year older than Edward, and I was pregnant again. Anyway, We weren't very far out when a squall came up. I mean, it came out of the blue with no warning. The wind kicked up and rain fell in torrents. It was a brand new yacht, but it began to break apart. My husband yelled for everybody to get into life jackets, which they did, while he radioed a mayday to the Coast Guard. And they answered right away. They were only a short distance from us. They said they could probably reach us within 5 or 10 minutes. That's when the yacht snapped completely in two. I screamed for the kids to jump in the water and hold hands. And in just a few seconds, we were in a circle treading water. I told them, sing at the top of your lungs. I really wasn't that worried. And the squall went as quickly as it had come. When it vanished, well, the water was calm as a lake again. I could even see the Coast Guard cutter headed toward us. Then I saw something else. I saw a fin. I knew it was a shark, but I didn't want the kids to be scared, so I didn't say anything. And we just kept on singing and holding hands, and suddenly the fin disappeared. Then Billy made a face and said that his life jacket was too tight, that it was hurting him. I knew what had happened. When there's a traumatic injury to our body, it tries to cut off blood flow by closing arteries. If he had suffered a bite to the lower part of his body, the constriction would make it feel like his jacket was too tight. I told him that help was almost here, and he could get out of the jacket in a minute. That's when Tex said that his jacket was hurting him, too. Well, the cutter reached us just about then. They saw that blood was pooling around the boys, so they pulled them into the boat first. When Tex and Billy were hauled out of the cold water, the blood vessels opened up, and they both died of shock within a matter of minutes. She said it in a matter-of-fact way, which made sense since she'd obviously told the story many times before. What I couldn't understand was how she managed to keep her sanity. Diana Jo plays herself in the documentary, she said in a soft voice. I didn't have words. I had no idea how to respond. How'd the woman go on? How could you go through something like that and survive, I wondered. All I could say was, I'm sorry again. But it sounded hollow, even in my own ears. Look, I finally said, I'd love to have somebody, a local coordinator, to take care of workshop details before I get to town. Is it possible for you to do something like that for me? She did an outstanding job. The Austin workshop, held at St. Edward's University, was a wonderful experience. Carol Pyrie from the Texas Film Commission was a speaker, and of course Donald Gold was with me. Later, when Diana opened a West Coast branch of her agency down the street from Warner Brothers Studio, I was briefly her literary rep. We've stayed friends through the years. Why was she compelled to call me the day she saw my ad? Was it only a coincidence that she, like Laura Mahean, had lost her son so tragically? With the PBS program due to repeat her story in a few days, maybe she needed to talk to somebody about her children, someone who would understand. Once again, I missed the meaning entirely. What I wondered was why she had contacted me when there was already a movie that had been made about her tragedy. Don't forget that business about me having to see that everybody's movie got made was what I understood my task to be. But it sure was perplexing me as to how I was going to get it all done. Diane, now living and working again in Texas, has given me permission to use the family's names. And I still marvel at that precious woman's strength.
You've been listening to Dear Dean, Love, Mom, told by its author Esther Luttrell, and brought to you by The Voice of Helona in association with Mojave Beach Productions. The Voice of Helona theme was composed and performed by David Randa of Fesleyan Studios. Patrick McGranahan produced. This production was recorded by Dean Fairweather. Funding for Dear Dean, Love, Mom was made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the support of all aspects of forgiveness in families, communities, businesses, and personal relationships. Visit their website at forgivenessfoundationinternational.com. This is Jeff Evans, inviting you to soar on the wings of imagination to Mojave Beach Productions' World of Audio Entertainment.
Mojave Beach Productions.
I just want to take a moment to thank you for soaring with us on the wings of imagination as you listen to stories we're having so much fun creating for you. If you enjoy what you hear, take a moment to subscribe to Mojave Beach Productions on your favorite podcast app. And thanks a million.